seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner. I've caddied for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
You're welcome along, friends, to Golf Weekly 2017 2.0. Fionn Davenport, hello.
Hey, Joe. Happy New Year.
And Nathan Murphy back for the first day after his 7 days off work. Hello. Ooh.
Hey, Joe.
How you doing?
Great.
Wearing a Hawaiian shirt for the season, that is.
Well, it is the Hawaiian swing, why not? I'm just excited about the Sony Open. Who isn't?
I'm genuinely excited. Yeah. It's our favourite swing of the year. When I think of Hawaii, I think of Jimmy Walker.
Twice winner.
Yeah. And I think of Nathan. And I think of me. We're the Hawaii trio. Hawaii swing's biggest fans.
For some reason, this year I wasn't quite as excited about it. I'm excited about Sony Open, but the Tournament of Champions. My only issue with the Tournament of Champions is it's too bloody easy.
It's a hell of a course.
It's
you just bow it
first,
up there.
The
it
first
rolls
five
down the
years,
hill.
The first 5 years was interesting to watch, but now I know exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Every single time.
It's lost some of the mystique. The quirks of the course are now. Oh yeah, you just hit it there and it rolls down. Okay, fine. I didn't watch much of it. Justin Thomas ran away with it.
Yeah, he had a little blip on, was it 14, 15, right, where he did double bogey. For a second it looked as though Matsuyama might come back into it. Like, the story is almost Matsuyama and how he has become the best player in the world over the past 2 or 3 months. And I guess we've learned our lessons from the last couple of years. Can he keep that going for the next 3 or 4 months to when it really matters?
Yeah, to be discussed. I caught a good bit of Matsuyama, funny enough. I caught more of Thursday, Friday, Saturday than Sunday. I wasn't that pumped about Sunday. Don't know why. We've much to get to in the meantime. We'll start with your tweets. It's nice to be back, everyone, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, you got new glasses.
I did. I lost my other ones.
They are very Harry Potter.
They are.
That's terrible.
I mean, they're
He means that as a good thing, I think.
No, I don't.
No, no. Oh. I prefer your 50-year-old hipster glasses.
Yeah, no, I...
Are they Harry Potters?
No. I mean, I don't know. I mean, Daniel Radcliffe gave them to me and said, here. But no, are they Harry Potter?
Are they not?
I didn't pick them.
They're more Golf Weekly presenter than Culture Show presenter.
Okay. Yeah.
We'll tweet out a picture on the @GolfWeekly.
No, please
NT.
Do. Yeah, we should.
Yeah, picture.
Yeah, no, because nothing like letting Twitter determine or judge. Yeah, love that.
Well, that aside, no, actually, that included, it's nice to be back with
yeah,
you
it is.
In the studio again. Richie on Twitter, RedTricky41, his tag or his whatever you call it.
Handle.
Can I look forward to a podcast this week? Yes, you can. Dave Kelly, podcast this week, lads, please. He also points out he really enjoyed Dermot Leese. Amazing to hear him saying, and he's right, that Tiger will win if he can get his head right. We'll play, we'll include Dermot Leese in this podcast. He was in studio on Sunday. There's an amazing story about Lee Elder. Did you hear Dermot Leese?
I heard the latter stages of him when he was sort of talking about the current.
Yeah. The really good stuff was, and the majority of the discussion is, 20 years ago since Tiger made his breakthrough at Augusta.
Yeah.
And Gleese was there. He's got some great stories. Lee Elder story is something else.
From the 70s or the 60s?
The 70s, but also, I would say, a mildly racist state trooper in 1997 stopping him on the way to the course story. And he met Lee Elder that night as well, the Tiger had won, and Elder was pumped, you know, about the whole thing. Gleese's great. You know, no one else can talk to you about chatting with Lee Elder that night.
I don't think Lee Elder's ever pulled any punches about all of the racism that he had to deal with.
No. Fairly upfront about it.
Yeah.
But I didn't realise, and I don't want to trample all over Gleese, he'll tell all the stories, but Augusta, realising what was happening, Tiger Woods was about to win, invited Elder out for the weekend to Augusta.
How cynical is that?
Well, Gleese actually seemed to give the impression that the chairman at the time, whose name escapes me, you'll hear it later on, was doing it in recognition of the fact that things weren't always so good. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Maybe
just before we move on, Joe, for any of our listeners who were running Fionn cynical bingo, the time was 4:30 into 2017.
Is this a thing?
I think it should become a thing.
Yeah.
Fionn cynical bingo. I like that. Trevor Scanlon. In relation to endorsements, what's your take on endorsing, because, you know, our Callaway thing. Which, by the way, Callaway, you have competition now. Just saying.
Who?
Well, I'll tell you later. Let's just say we're big fans of the Irish Open 2017.
Did you see? Did you see? And I like
frantically trying to think of the list of sponsors of the Irish Open.
We, in our last pod, we had our shot of the year, where I think we were all more or less in agreement. Well,
Rory at the 16th.
Rory at the 16th.
Yeah. I thought Jason Day.
What are we? European Tour shot of the year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rory at the 18th.
Nonsense. Yeah. Even Rory will tell you himself the 16th was far better.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. What do golf fans know?
Never put these things to an open vote.
No.
Democracy doesn't work.
I think that's been proved a few times.
As Kent Brockman has said. You know, I've said it once, I've said it 1,000 times.
What was Churchill's thing? The best argument against democracy is talk to a voter for five minutes.
Yeah. But he also said, democracy is the worst form of government except for all the other forms of government.
Mm. Yeah. He's probably right about that. Mm. But not definitely.
Have you been watching The Crown? We have this conversation. I've watched it all.
Is it 2016 again? Yeah, no, we finished it.
Oh, that was brilliant.
Did you?
I still haven't watched it. I'm still finishing off House of
Cards. John Lithgow as Churchill is terrific.
How can you still be finishing off House of Cards? You've been off for a week.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I have two bloody children, so I get one episode a night before I collapse asleep.
That sounds terrible. Mm. The Crown is good, yeah. No, good.
What about Little Billy?
Very good.
Little Billy, he's back. He was interviewing Beef. Was that pre-Rory or after Rory? I only saw it this week.
Oh, then
not as good.
Post Rory, haven't seen it.
He had a peak with Rory.
They're
stretching. Just move on.
Of course, he plays
stretching Beef a bit thin.
He plays Prince Charles, the young Prince Charles in The Crown. Yeah,
The Crown, if I'm not mistaken, will do each decade.
Yes,
over five series.
Which I think you made the point before is that you have to be kind of committed to that historical analysis of. But it's I think it's terrific. The acting's brilliant. And,
yeah, no, it's very good. Mm. Yeah,
definitely had this exact conversation. In
yeah,
the
okay.
Last
sorry, let's move on.
Apologies to everyone. You're on season two though, House of Cards. Surely,
I've just I literally finished season two last night.
Right, okay. So, and there is a season three
and a season four
and a season four
and season five is coming out soon.
That's ridiculous. I've watched all the four seasons. And, that's how quickly you forget.
And
these
Rooney
things.
Mara, who plays the reporter from season one, she is the granddaughter of Dan Rooney of the Pittsburgh Steelers and of Mara. I can't remember his first name, of the New York Giants.
Yeah. Wow. Mm. Okay. This is a nice catch-up, actually, because we haven't actually spoken, really. We just came in here. It's good to...
How was your Christmas, Joe?
Quiet.
Nobody spoke?
Just finished listening to the December podcast. Great job, guys. 2016 pods were magic. Thanks very much, Kevin Kelly. Looking forward to 2017. Keep her lit. Adrian Bain sent us a picture of him effectively... just covered up in all sorts of garments and wool and hats on a golf course, saying, not the same as playing in Hawaii, but you hit one good strike and it's worth freezing your brass monkeys off. Love the pod. John Kelly, I caught up on the last four pods while trying to walk the madness out of our new pup. Happy New Year, man. It's kind of a nice thing, isn't it? And John adds, I'd recommend The Match by Mark Frost as a brilliant golf read and possible topic for discussion on a pod. Conor Deegan gave me The Match as a lend. I still have it. I must read it. Meant to be very good. Yeah, we might get around to that. Might do some golf books this year.
Hmm.
And obviously, like all the promises we make to you, we won't. Shane Fitzy, new year, new me, but where's the new golf podcast? Hashtag bull and fit. It's Shane working out. Great pod all year, lads. Looking forward to 2017. Not happy with the big pod picture ident of Joe. It smacks of narcissism. You're an ensemble. Well, we've talked about that as well.
Should we have that conversation on air again?
Yeah. Can I, just before Christmas, I don't think I played with one of the listeners, Jeff, Stockport. I have to say, and I'll say it, I'll give a shout out, terrific day out. Really, really good fun.
Terrific.
Terrific. It was terrific it was. No, it was really brilliant.
How did this happen again? Jeff tweeted you?
Yeah, he just tweeted and said, talking about living over there, and so he said, listen, anytime you're up for a game at Stockport. So I went along, I played with him and another member, and Jeff's
your girlfriend,
future son-in-law, maybe future son-in-law,
right? Hopefully. Don't screw it up.
Yeah, don't mess it up. And who's also a listener of the pod. And the four of us had a really nice day in Stockport. Class
nice
act,
course.
I have to say. It is a lovely course, and it had been wet, so it wasn't probably in its pristine best, but it is. It's a terrific, it's like a really old course. It's over 100 years old.
Right.
Just by way of curiosity, I was a little taken. The Davenports originated from that very part of South Stockport.
No.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you know that before?
I had an inkling. I'd asked my dad and he said somewhere in Cheshire, originally going back like 500 years. And it was confirmed that where Stockport Golf Club was originally located was in the townland of Davenport And
there's a town called Davenport.
It was kind of an area. And I have to say, like, I wouldn't know that much about my family history going back more than a couple of generations. And it really, I have to say, it touched me. I found it quite a profound thing.
Really?
A little bit, yeah.
You should be cynical about that as
well. No. I was really, I don't mean is that I wanted to plant a flag and, you know, but at the same time, there was something about kind of, in some esoteric way, connecting to somewhere that your people originally came from.
It's a triumph of humanity, you know.
Yeah, there's something quite nice about it, so.
Right.
I'm a big fan of Stockport Golf Club.
Are the Davenports a proud people?
They're a proud people. No, they came.
It's cynical by nature.
No, yeah.
A number of years ago, I was doing a talk on tourism down in Kerry, and I met one of these Shanachie, whose name now unfortunately escapes me, but he'd asked me about my name, and this guy who's really kind of rooted in Irish lore and knew a lot about Irish history, etc. And he goes, "The Davenports, that'd be a name from North Clare, South Galway." And I was like, "Yeah, my grandfather's raised in Kinvara." And so he was like, "Yes." And he goes, and I says, "Do you know?" And he goes, "Yes. I think they came over with Cromwell's army." And I was like, dear. Oh my God.
Makes a lot of sense.
It really was. It was
disgusting.
One of those. Yeah.
It's all starting
drummers in Cromwell's army, I was told.
Drummers?
Mm.
Oh,
yeah.
That's not so bad.
Yeah.
You know.
Keeping a beat.
Yeah, killing people.
Yeah.
Was there a requirement for drummers to kill people if...
No, absolutely not.
You had one job.
And then the Davenports settled.
I didn't realise Cromwell brought drummers.
Well, there would have been a bit of a march. Like, you know, for
soldiers to keep people
marching.
In time, yeah.
So that's... Right, and okay. They came from Cheshire, from Davenport in Cheshire.
Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah.
And you had a good day with the friends.
Very good.
That's good. That's good. Did you feel like you were prostituting yourself out, you know? Trading on your celebrity?
Well, no, because they had that perfect mix of they liked the pod, but they didn't really want to. They didn't talk about the pod that much.
Did they ask about me? No.
No.
Okay.
They asked about Nathan a lot.
Yeah. I know nothing about the Malloys. I'm sad to say, really.
Well, the Murphys
are everywhere.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course they are.
I think the Malloys might have got involved with some of those Spanish that were rocked up on Mayo.
Oh, yeah.
I think they like...
Mayo name.
I think a few of the Malloys women like the look of some of those Spanish
lads.
There's
a swarthy look about you, Joe.
No, I think some of those Spanish...
Although there's a swarthy look about our Nathan as well.
Well, I think everybody in the West of Ireland has a bit of Spanish in them.
Mm.
Isn't that what they say?
Oh,
dear. Right, if you're still with us, we are moving on to talk golf. So, we'll get on to Rory McIlroy in a few moments, who's done a huge interview with Paul Kimmich. Part one, part two to come, and also spoken with the BBC about effectively not wanting to play in the Olympics ever, it seems. But just some bits and bobs going on at the moment. Jim Furyk this evening will be announced as USA Ryder Cup team captain for 2016. 46-year-old assistant to Davis Love for the last victory at Hazeltine. Appears to have been given the nod. Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson on the committee who've voted for Jim. Confirmation expected tonight. Furyk's appeared in 9 events as a player. His main rival for the job was Fred Couples, who wanted the captaincy for 2016 but was passed over in favour of Love.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, was...
Yeah, wanted it for the one just gone.
Oh, sorry. Oh, so his main... Okay, so... Oh, so Couples passed over twice.
Yeah.
Oh, what's the deal with Fred Couples? I think
he's been passed over even a couple of times before that. Like, he's made no secret that he wanted to be the Ryder Cup captain. And it's strange because he still turns up on tour, so he is relevant, but maybe it's just moved on. And you look at the appointment of someone like Jim Furyk, who is very much still a tour player, who the only surprise of him getting it is that, like, Furyk would have been thereabouts in terms of getting a wild card at the very least next time around.
Sure.
It's interesting though, Couples would have the credentials. He'll still be leading the Masters after round 2 this year. I wonder, is there a popularity thing? He seems like a relatively popular guy.
Do you get the impression that he's one of the more likeable guys? I know nothing about him other than his general demeanour is very likeable.
Maybe he's too relaxed.
Got a bad back, of course.
He does have a bad back. But he has a beautiful swing.
Oh, well. I mean, I think that is the all-time one for me.
Mm.
Couples. Yeah. So, Furyk, solid choice, good guy, won't be an ego, will listen to everybody. Everything that Watson wasn't, and they've decided we're never having a Watson again.
Yeah.
That's the Furyk ticks all those boxes.
He's a brilliant choice, and they've got a good line of potential captains now. I wonder... When you compare him to Thomas Bjorn and going back to Darren Clark's captaincy, like, Furyk is still... he gets the younger players there. So they're all multi-millionaires. He understands.
He sure does. He's fourth on the all-time list.
Well, exactly, but they have a very similar life. They stay in the same hotels. They travel on their private jet with the younger members of that team. I wonder at times now with the European players, like the final four or five in that European team are just starting to emerge. Mm. They're not multi-millionaires. They're not traveling on the PGA Tour. And can the captain now, who has had a very successful career in Thomas Bjorn's case and in Darren Clark's case, can he really relate to those younger players anymore? Or has he lived his life for the last 20 years so differently that... Mm. Maybe there's an issue there.
But is it, I mean, was Watson just a particularly egregious example of not relating? Because he's an old-fashioned guy, and whether he is the age he is or whether he was 20 years younger, that you get the feeling that Watson was always going to adopt, look, you're a good player, just go out and play. Mm. And, like, do you think that other players, no matter... Like, do you not think that Darren Clark still can relate to young players? Like, he knows what it's like to be rich, he knows what it's like to earn tons of money and to have the distractions that come with that.
But what I'm saying is a lot of the players on the European Tour aren't super rich, that are the guys who are just about scraping their way onto the team, that they aren't, and that there's sort of a, and maybe they don't have the talent of Darren Clark and never had the potential that Darren Clark, and maybe similarly with Thomas Bjorn, but that the way the European Tour is now set up, that the final four who qualify are sort of like they're not contending for majors. Mm-hmm. They're players who played well at a particular time on the European Tour. Fjork just strikes me as being the perfect captain.
Yeah, very good, very solid.
Do you think the choice of venue will play a part?
How so?
Just, you know, home advantage or if there is such a thing.
Huge. So, you know, Harrington was on even shortly after Hazeltine, and the rough is obviously one issue, he said, but also the greens, like, you know, the fast greens, Americans are so used to them, and they come over and play 12
slower
on the
greens.
Stimulator, and they hate the greens. They just hate the greens, and of course, it is a putting contest. So he said that was, you know, the biggest advantage, plus whatever extra benefits you get from the crowd, which must be worth a point or two, surely.
Will there be a big crowd?
I'd imagine so. Le Golf National, though, always struck me as more of an American course than a European course. So the last two events here were Gleneagles at the beginning of October in Scotland and Celtic Manor, which was more or less a washout.
Yeah.
Whereas watching Le Golf National on TV, and certainly the final few holes, have always set up as a very American style.
Yeah.
But again, they've got 2 years. Bjorn has 2 years to change the course, change the greens, so whatever way he wants.
I was listening to John Hogan make the point that... he thinks they're going to have to actually calm this whole Ryder Cup thing down a little bit. He made the point that the behaviour on the course that he saw in Hazeltine was actually far, far worse than the Europeans have even let on. The Europeans are very consciously not trying to appear sour and make a big deal about it. But Hogan was arguing, it was with Lawrence Donegan on their podcast, saying it was actually a disgrace.
Yeah.
It was really bad. It was out of control. And do they want to maintain some kind of integrity, or do they just want to sell as many plastic things of beer as possible, make as much money as possible, and screw how the event feels?
The latter.
I thought that was fairly obvious as well. They don't. I mean, they would view it as a complete success, I presume.
Yeah, and we weren't there, so we don't know exactly. But if he's saying it was a disgrace, it was obviously overstepping the mark.
Mm.
But you get the sense, the way the Ryder Cup has gone, that nobody's an issue with the mark being overstepped.
Yeah.
That the more headlines it gets, the more attention it gets for that couple of weeks, the better.
Yeah.
A question for you, gentlemen. Will Tiger Woods play his way onto this team? Tiger Woods' schedule, I mean, this has just electrified the whole opening couple of the weeks. So Tiger's going to play 4 events in 5 weeks, Fionn. That's 4 and 5. He's going to be... When is he first up? Torrey Pines, it looks like. Yeah, Torrey Pines, naturally, where he's won 8 times in California. That'll be January 26th. Then he'll go from Torrey Pines to Dubai, where he'll play on the European Tour. He will play Riviera in February. He will also play the Honda Classic in February. Nota Begay, he will win in 2017. He will win if he plays this many events, I would think. So... he's back and he's going for it.
And it's a sign that his back is okay.
Yeah, that's what I took from it.
Yeah,
4 and 5 weeks, unbelievable. This is now must-watch television.
He has to go and do it.
Sure.
He has to go and play these 4 tournaments over for the next 5 weeks.
Good, I think, is generally the consensus, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. This is amazing. I mean,
this will be the test. This should define the rest of his year. Like, he's playing difficult courses. I know he's got an incredible record at
a Torrey Pines in particular. But it's not an easy golf course. It's not playing in the Bahamas a nice little four rounds with 17 other people in the field.
Yeah.
It's going to be a lot of pressure.
And he has struggled at Torrey Pines since 08 in his comeback. So that was the other Tiger Woods news. We will move on to Rory McIlroy. So Rory McIlroy making headlines everywhere for his piece with Paul Kimmage in the Sunday Independent over here in little old Ireland, foreign listeners. Just the, I'd say, 5,000 to 6,000 words, maybe. Part one.
Yeah.
So in all, this is going to be a 10,000 worder interview. Kimmage met him at a hotel a couple of weeks ago on a Tuesday morning, I think. And the piece opens with him bemoaning the fact that he knew Rory as a young kid and didn't quite stay friends with him. And so, you know, got off that train. But he texted him when he arrived at the hotel at 7:45 a.m. and said, unsure. And McIlroy came down and Kimmage said, I didn't know if you'd know what that meant. You know, I took a bit of a chance there. And McIlroy flashed him a big smile and held out his phone and said, I had to Google it. And that kicked off much of the discussion. It was, I mean, much of the early parts of the interview were about McIlroy's very conflicted sense of identity.
The piece, and I wonder what you guys think, it's typical Kimmage, you know, like who imbues a real sense of drama into the... It just... literally through syntax, you know, like word, paragraph, word, word, word. And he builds this wonderful tension. So even though I think you kind of had to dig a little in the interview, but there's some really good stuff in there, like a really, really good. There's an awful lot I thought of. Like Kimmage really kind of lays out his opinion of Rory, which is perfectly within his remit. So you get the feeling, one is Kimmage is a big, big fan. There's no question that there's a big admirer, both of his sporting accomplishments, but also of the manner in which he has negotiated all of the challenges that come with being Rory McIlroy since the age of 14. And that's very clear. But as you said, Joe, like there's some really good stuff in there. I thought, for me, the standout stuff is his absolutely unequivocal position on the Olympics, which I found both cogent, really articulate, and frankly, really admirable in the age of... don't say anything that could possibly be in any way controversial. And he does. And he says things and he goes, look, this is my opinion. And that's brilliant.
Yeah, we had Dick Clerkin in on the paper review, who played football for Monaghan, obviously, for years. And he was reading this. And, you know, if you were to boil down Rory's point here, and we can read out some quotes, but if you were to really boil it down, he would say, look, I'm not from down there. I'm not from over there. I'm Northern Ireland. And that's a weird mix.
Yeah.
And even Dick was saying... that's a really big thing to say, actually.
It is.
That upsets people. Even Dick was saying, you guys aren't from Northern Ireland. Don't underestimate it. That's a ballsy thing to come out and say.
But it also echoes a new generation. Like, obviously, Rory's a good bit younger than me.
But Rory's 10 years old in the Good Friday Agreement.
Exactly. So Rory grew up in an era where the politics of the past are to be dispensed with or to be moved away from as quickly as you possibly can because they're stultifying no matter what side you are on. And so Rory represents new Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And I think his opinions, I would wager that if you took a straw poll of, you know, 1,000 kids people under 30 in Northern Ireland, they'd all go, yeah, completely. Yeah, absolutely.
I thought it was the Northern Ireland millennial emerging.
Absolutely.
Actually. Yeah.
He said, sorry, Nathan, I'll let you in. But just to give people a sense, if you haven't read the piece, and obviously it's recommended. I sent Justin Rose a text after he won at the Olympics. I think I still have the message. I'm happy for you, mate. I saw how much it means to you. Congratulations. He said, thanks very much. All the boys here want to know, do you feel like you missed out? I said, Justin, if I'd been on the podium listening to the Irish National Anthem as that flag went up, or the British National Anthem as that flag went up, I would have felt uncomfortable either way. I don't know the words to either anthem. I don't feel a connection to either flag. I don't want it to be a bit of flag. I've tried to stay away from that. And then he went on to say, not everyone's driven by nationalism, patriotism. That's never been me because I felt like I grew up in a place where I wasn't allowed to be. It was suppressed. I'm very conflicted because I'm a Catholic. And Kimmage says, you don't know what unsure means. And he says, exactly. I turned on the TV at home. It was BBC. I did my GCSEs. I used pounds sterling, stuff like that. So I'm a Catholic. but I feel very much Northern Irish. I never wanted to get political about it or where I'm from, but that's what it turned into. And it got to the point where it wasn't worth the hassle. And then a final point. I spend a lot of time in Dublin. I love it. I love the people here and I love the people from up north. And it's been a hard thing for me to go through because as much as I enjoy Katie Taylor boxing or the lads getting silver in the rowing, which is unbelievable and inspirational, I also enjoy Justin Rose winning the gold medal in golf or Mo Farah winning the 10,000 metres. Kimmage. Oh, Jesus, not Mo Farah.
I thought that was very funny.
McIlroy. Okay, Jessica Ennis. Kimmage, fine.
That was very funny.
Very eloquent. Yeah. Very good.
Yeah, and McIlroy's willingness to hold himself up to scrutiny is something that just constantly impresses. That he went out, I won't say on a limb, but was the first to pull out of the Olympics because of the Zika virus, went fully in with that, has been slated for that decision, questioned about whether he was being totally honest. A lot of us defended him, saying that, yeah, if that's his reasoning, we got to believe it. Mm. But then to come out, and he's done this throughout his career, to change his mind, to come out and say, actually, yeah, this is what I thought all along. And if he, I do wonder what the reaction would have been if he'd stood up in a press conference. And we should remember he backed himself into a corner because he came out and announced 2 days before an Irish Open a couple of years ago that he was going to declare for Ireland. But if he came out in May and said, I don't feel any allegiance to either flag.
Yeah.
That if I was standing up there in Rio with the Irish flag going up, all I'd be thinking is, this isn't going to go down well with certain people back at home.
Yeah.
And the opposite.
Yeah.
Either way,
yeah,
I can't win. Now, it's a very difficult thing to do. Maybe it is a lot easier when you sit down. Maybe you should have done this interview 6 months ago or 9 months ago and given that very honest view. But I think we spoke about this on the pod before, that he sees himself as Northern Irish. Who does he support in sport?
United.
He follows Ulster. No, but he follows Ulster.
Oh yeah, Ulster.
He,
yeah, sorry.
You know, he invests in Ulster.
Yeah.
He went to France during the summer to support Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And even in France during the summer, there was a sense of a Northern Ireland. There was Catholics there, there was Protestants there, yeah, supporting this team. And I know a lot of the Catholics in Northern Ireland support the Republic.
Yeah.
But there was a coming together of young people from Northern Ireland, probably for the first time in their life, to get behind a new country.
Yeah, yeah,
that's, I think,
now,
that's very...
Now, he's right.
Well, like, maybe it's
that doesn't go down well.
Yeah, no, sure. It doesn't, but... I mean, maybe it's just the arrogance of youth here, but it is its own country.
Yeah.
Like, I think, hands off everyone. It's gone too far now. Let's draw it on the sand. It's its own country.
There is also, and Kimmage touches on it, and I'm kind of drawing from other things that Rory has said, but like he resents the idea of like, oh, you're going to grow the game. And he goes, what the hell does that mean? You know, I perform. Yeah. But, and then there's another quote that he goes, maybe I shouldn't have reacted the way I did, but Olympic golf to me doesn't mean that much. It really doesn't. I don't get excited about it, and people can disagree and have a different opinion, and that's totally fine, each to their own. So perhaps his opinion of the Olympics is informed exclusively by his ambivalence about what flag is he meant to stand under, etc., and all of that conflict that exists in his mind. But I also think as well is that there's another issue, is that, you know, this is a guy whose schedule is carefully monitored, created over the course of a year. And I think for him, I think it goes back to that thing of, in the end, like, how many Olympic titles are you going to win? Like, he doesn't care. It means nothing to him.
We got
to
mention, there was an interesting point made recently on one of the radio stations here, News Talk's Off the Ball, wondering whether it was because you were viewed or were perceived as more Planet Nike than Citizen of Ireland. What does that mean?
Yeah.
I remember, oh shit. Kimmage, that you're a global brand, I guess. McIlroy, yeah, maybe. I was like, thank God.
Yeah.
Golf is a global game. You play around the world. You have obligations to sponsors who play large money, endorse their product, and that's part of it as well. Kimmage says, they also wonder, what more can he do? He saved the Irish Open. He was on the Late Late Show. Did we say that?
Yes, I thought we said that during the pod.
Okay.
Or maybe we said it on air one night.
I think Richie claimed credit for the Late Late Show line. He's great in interviews. He's great with the media. And McIlroy said, I live my life. I live it the way I want to. I'm not going to lose any sleep if I'm not in the shortlist for the RTE Sports Awards or BBC. That's not the reason I play the game.
No.
His perfect day involves getting up at 7 a.m. and going to the gym.
In Florida.
Yeah, but then equally he was like, yeah. He said, but I also think straight away about Northern Ireland, about being in Northern Ireland. So what does he say here? Although, yeah, okay. So I've always been an early riser. I get that from my dad. He always says, best part of the day, you get so much done. So I'd get back from the gym. I'd have breakfast with Erica. I mean, honestly, my perfect day wouldn't be playing golf. So what do you do, says Kimmich? It's funny. I keep thinking of Florida for some reason. I guess it's where we spent most of our time on the days when I'm not working. Erica's parents have the dog, Lily, which we adore. Spend a bit of time on the beach with them. So yeah, I guess it's leaning towards Florida.
There's also very good. The piece has some really interesting insights into Rory McIlroy's thinking. There's the anecdote about coming back from the Mullingar Scratch Cup as a young kid, and just for anyone who doesn't know, so August 2006. And by that point, I'm 16 and I've won the West and the Close. And for non-Irish listeners, these are like two big championships for amateur golf here. I've been travelling a lot, driving around Ireland with Dad in a silver Mondeo, and I just won the Mullingar Scratch Cup. I should have been happy because I'd lost in a playoff the year before, but I remember driving back and it was somewhere just over the border and I started to cry. I'm not enjoying this anymore. I started to punch the window and just had this complete outburst. And so you've got this kid who for the previous 7 years has been on the fast track to golfing greatness. He'd won his World Junior Championship. He was already been talked about in Irish golf circles. And you could see him reacting against being on the gerbil wheel, or, you know, and the hamster wheel.
Yeah.
And his father, and Jerry obviously takes a very pragmatic but also good fatherly approach and goes, look, take 3 days, have it, just relax, don't worry about it. And sure enough, he gets over it. Now, later on, he talks about being what he thinks about Tiger's level of fame and that idea that Tiger, like, he'll go, Tiger, do you want to come over for dinner? And Tiger's like, I can't, I just can't. And he goes, I would hate that. I would absolutely hate that. So right from an early age, you get the feeling of a young man who, despite his prodigious ability, is struggling to strike balance. And I know that we've talked about a lot about there's something kind of to watch this struggle, and he performs this struggle in public a lot in his interviews. But like, it goes back a few years ago when he goes, it's not that big a deal, you know?
Yeah. Do you think he struggles to get the balance?
No, I don't think, I think he did. I think turning pro, I think signing the Nike contract, I think these were big speed bumps.
He talks about it very well, actually.
Yeah, I think he's really, very articulate.
Kim and Jason, when does it get a bit mental for you? And so he says, probably after when I won my first major in 2011, exposed to all these different things, felt like I had a different status. As a 22-year-old, it's very easy to be taken in by meeting all these people and thinking, oh, cool, I've got such and such's number. I just hung out with whoever last night. You're enjoying yourself, having a great time, but it's not real, it's not fulfilling, it's not meaningful. And then he says, Kimmich says, so when did that change? Or, you know, there must have been some moment where that light switch went on. And he said, the day I always go back to is 2013 Open at Muirfield. That was Phil Mickelson's win. Most homesick I've ever felt, which didn't make sense because I spent the whole week back the week before with my friends and family at home. I don't know. I was just a bit lost, I suppose. Game wasn't great. My personal life was very up and down. And I didn't have a what's the word? Pause. And McIlroy goes on to say, he spoke with a psychologist, sports psychologist, the following week after Muirfield. And he remembers saying to the psychologist, I miss home. I miss having a home. I miss my friends. I miss my family. I miss having something that centers you. That's the word, something that centers you, something that you can go back to and know that everything will be okay. And he was talking about how it was just on this endless cycle of golf tournament, tennis tournament, sponsorship event. And it was just, as you said, you know, even from his teenage years, it was just the
hamster wheel.
Yeah, he only saw that sports psychologist once though,
and he was strangely reluctant to, like, or the tone certainly that comes across in the piece is because he also mentions working for a brief amount of time with Bob Rotella
in 2010.
Yeah, so he's saying, like, I've never really, sports psychologists in me, it's not, that's, I can figure stuff out for the most part myself. And I was surprised at that because I thought in the modern age that golfers, like, you know, golf psychologists are two a penny now, you know, that everyone's committing to.
Yeah,
a lot of bad ones out there.
Sure.
I almost got the sense during that section of it that he was being quite harsh on himself.
Yeah,
that he's,
I thought,
been
so too.
Far more centered than the vast majority of people in his position could ever have been. And going back to coming back from the Mullingar Scratch Cup, like, if that was the low point.
Yeah, like, he's not had that many.
As a teenager, yeah. That you had one tantrum basically where you turned around and said, no, this isn't for me. Like, he's doing incredibly well there. And, all right, we all know about the issues he's had with changing clubs, with management companies, with his relationships, because he's had to live it in the public eye. But he's never lashed out. There's never been an incident where he's let himself down
very badly
during any of those.
Yeah, true. On the Woods thing, he makes the point, you know, so he talks about, as you were saying, playing golf at Woods. Do you want to go out for dinner? Woods says, I can't. You know, just too bad. And McIlroy says, you know, for me, that's unfathomable. I could not live like that. If someone was to say to me, you can have 14 majors and 70 wins, but have to deal with that, or 9 majors and 40 wins and stay somewhat the same as you are, I'd take the second option all day. Part of me's like, ugh.
No. But I wonder, you see, the other side of that is, if somehow you could force Rory McIlroy into that lifestyle,
yeah,
would he win 14 majors?
I think that's a good point.
Mm. Or would his game... There's a sort of comparison with the criticisms that are there of Wayne Rooney at the moment in football of if he'd lived his life differently, if he'd lived his life the way Cristiano Ronaldo lives his life, he'd have fulfilled his potential. Maybe this is his potential. Maybe the way he lived his life was the only way he could
cope.
To get the best to cope with it. And Rory's never, it seems, had the personality to live a Tiger lifestyle.
Hmm. He went on to say he wants to become the best ever European player records-wise. And he said that before. He said that on the No Laying Up podcast. Hmm. So Faldo at the moment obviously has 6. But then for the first time I've heard him say, and maybe get to double-digit majors. It's the first time I've heard him mention double-digit as a target. He's shied away from any kind of target. So now I'm thinking, okay, 10. He's got 10 somewhere. I think he's got 10, 11 floating around his head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How old is he now?
27.
Yeah, I mean, all of us, he's got 4, you know. 10's still a ways away.
6 over the next 15 years. It's less than 1 every 2 years.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's doable.
Of course it's doable.
The great thing about golf is we can make these predictions and in 15 years, the chats of someone come back and go like, remember when you said that?
I
did love that last section of the relationship with Tiger some of the almost cockiness of McIlroy going, some of the messages he had sent Tiger over the years.
Yeah.
And even the way Tiger seemed to embrace having Tiger sees Rory as his only natural rival, even with Dustin Johnson and Jason.
Yeah.
Day,
but is that true?
Jordan Spieth.
Or is that just not a Nike concoction? Like the part in it, like the Ripple ad, it's a good ad, but like, I just think it's funny. Like, there's no, you can't get away from Nike branding is very powerful and very strong.
Sure.
But
Kimmich did push him as much as he could in the relationship. And, you know, McIlroy was making the point in it that we're at the point where Tiger tells me things about himself that he would only tell friends.
Yeah.
So that's definitely beyond the friendship of convenience.
Sure, absolutely. Or that, you know, that they were put together as obviously the premier Nike athletes. And so as a result of that, they've gotten to know each other. And there's no doubt that I've no reason to, you know, I thought it was interesting the stuff about like Tiger texting him at 4 o'clock in the morning, what are you doing? I'm lifting weights. And you're like, get away from me, you freak.
Tiger's set that message to send while he's fast
asleep.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And
McIlroy said Erica gets annoyed at the phone beeping.
And then Kimmich throws in, I'm with Erica.
I'm drawn to him. He's an intriguing character.
I'm drawn to
you
him.
Could spend 2 hours in his company and see 4 different sides to him. Imagine. Like, I don't think that's that remarkable.
No.
When he's comfortable and he trusts you, and his trust sensitivity is way higher than mine. Interesting point. He's great. He's thoughtful. He's smart. He reads. He can't sleep. So he does. So that's all he does. He reads stuff and educates himself and everything. But he struggles to sleep, which I think is an effective overtraining. He texts me at 4 a.m. in the morning saying, uplifting, what are you doing?
Yeah. It's a weird thing to text somebody. Uplifting. But I thought it's, again, just about Tiger, because in my mind, anything that sounds real about Tiger is interesting. But the fact that Tiger can't sleep. I don't believe a lot of stuff, only because it's filtered through PR. And
it was December 2014. Obviously, the Masters was on Tiger's radar, and he says to me, I'm not going to let you win that slam. I said, you're not going to beat me. So we had this back and forth, and some of the guys he's beaten to win majors, and I said, you've never had to face someone like me.
That's the line.
Ugh.
That is the killer
and
line.
And it's also true.
I guess it is.
No one's ever had to face anyone like Tiger.
No, Rory said that to Tiger.
Oh!
You ain't beat anybody like me.
Cocky little.
Nice. But I think that is McIlroy. It's cocky, but it's extremely confident, but it's not.
Yeah, it's not arsehole.
It's almost not, arsehole-y cocky.
There's truth in there, you know? There's enough truth in there.
Of all those players, Rory is the one who has the most potential to properly take on Tiger.
Yeah.
Is it interesting that it seems as though the two people that Tiger is currently closest to, of the current golfers, are Rory and Jason Day, that he surrounds himself with the best, that he almost wants a rivalry. He needs the motivation of seeing what they're doing.
Yeah.
To try and get the best out of himself again.
Yeah, interesting. McIlroy is playing this week, the South African Open. He's got to pay back all these people who came to the Irish Open, so it's Ernie Els' turn. So he's stuck at the South African Open. He's 2-1 favourite. Next favourites are all at 12-1. So Brandon Stone, Andy Sullivan's there, Thomas Aiken is there, Jaco van Ziel is there, Richard Bland is there. George could see us there. Rory is sticking out a mile here in this field.
I was going to say, is this like, I mean, obviously golf is unpredictable, but like, you know, it's as easy a possible W on the belt as there is.
The other thing to mention is that scandalously, Callaway, he's decided to try other equipment. So, Sorry, he was using the TaylorMade Woods, Nike irons and wedges and Scotty Cameron in the World Tour Championship in Dubai. So he was using those TaylorMade Woods. So he's now going to try the Callaway driver, the Callaway Woods, and the Callaway irons. And he's going to play the Titleist Pro.
Very good choice,
ball,
I think.
obviously,
for a player of his talent.
Yeah, absolutely.
His pedigree.
Although it must be pointed out that Callaway makes clubs for all degree of golfer.
It just gets the best out of
golfing ability. It really does, you know.
Whether you're particularly at the Premier tournament on the European Tour, the Irish Open.
Yeah.
You'd be mad to miss the Irish Open, that's all I think.
Yes, you would.
So listen, McIlroy, obviously on the back of the Kimmage interview, is now fielding lots of questions about his identity in the Olympics, and he spoke with the BBC's Mark Watson.
People are already talking about the Games in 4 years' time. Do you ever get a sort of sense that you'd like to draw a line under all that now and say, look, I'm not going in 4 years' time, so that people stop asking you about it?
Yeah, exactly. I'm a very conflicted person, and not a lot of people understand that maybe, but it's the way I feel, and I know that some people will, or most people think that is wrong, but it's the way I feel, and I can't really help it, I guess. More likely than not, I won't be going to the Games in 2020 just because of my personal feelings towards, not the Olympic Games. The Olympic Games are great, and I think golf included in the Olympic Games is fantastic, but just for me, it's something that I just don't want to get into, and you know, that's a personal choice, and hopefully people respect that decision.
Yeah, perhaps that's just because of where you're from.
Yeah, exactly, but it's not to say that where I'm from is a bad place. Northern Ireland is one of the best places on earth, and I try to get back there as much as I can, and the people are great, and that will always be home for me. But again, it's a personal decision, and it's a decision that I haven't taken lightly, and a decision that I've fought with myself over for so many years. And I guess, you know, the comments that I made at the Open, maybe one question too many, or I just flipped a little bit, and I maybe said something off the cuff that went a little bit too far, but it was always in there, it was always there at the back of my mind, and that day I came to the front of my mind and sort of let it go. But I think golf in the Olympics is a great thing. It went so good this year, or last year in 16, and I hope it goes even better in 2020. I just probably won't be a part of it.
You are refreshingly honest. Do you regret sometimes that you can't help just speaking your mind?
Not really. I think people appreciate it. I think people appreciate honesty. I don't want to stand up here and give you answers that you're already expecting. I want to give you honest answers and give you answers how I actually feel about things, and I think it's okay to have an opinion sometimes. I don't think that's wrong. So, and I've actually had to realize that over the years. And once I've become more comfortable myself, and it goes back to what I said before, where if you're comfortable in your own skin and you're comfortable with who you are as a person, it's okay to have opinions. It's okay to be a little bit different from the norm. And I've accepted that. And I think that's because I'm happy in my life and I'm happy with who I am. And, I'm able to give these opinions and not really... If it upsets some people, that's okay. I can't please everyone, but at least, I keep saying this, as long as I'm true to myself, I'll be happy.
There we go. No arguments here, I suppose.
Not good to Tokyo.
No. No Tokyo. So will we move on? Because we'll talk about Rory invariably next week, because part two of Kimmage McIlroy is...
You're going to be talking
imminent.
To Kimmage on Sunday, I'm sure.
Any question requests?
About this. No, well, what I found interesting reading this was... Like, some of his best pieces of the last 2 or 3 years have been about golf.
Yeah, McDowell,
the McDowell Harrington. Interview, Harrington, even the piece he did on Dermot Gallis.
Yeah.
That it seems as though actually the one sport that Kimmage still loves and believes in is golf.
He would say so himself.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a bastion of sense for him in the crazy years.
I'd just be curious, with Rory's busy schedule, how long was the lead time in setting up the interview? Just, I mean, it's more of a professional curiosity than anything
I'll
else.
Ask. That's a good question. Yeah. I'll ask. Yeah. How did this come about?
Yeah.
All these kind of questions will...
Well, Rory has traditionally, because he's spoken to us in the past around Christmas, he does interviews. He spends a bit of time in Dublin in the weeks leading up to Christmas.
Yeah.
And speaks to various reporters.
Yeah. We might play some of Kimmage from the papers on next week's pod for those who don't catch it and just get his take on it. I heard him speaking on Matt Cooper on Monday, and he was just saying, like, you do interviews with people and you try and push buttons and you hope you get a green light back. You know, and quite often you get red lights back and you can't go there and you can't go there. And he said McIlroy just, everything was green light.
What's the impression you get?
And he was, I was kissing the pavement afterwards. I came out of the hotel like, yes, this is great.
Yeah.
We'll have more Rory thoughts. I presume we'll get into more modern territory maybe with him next week. Obviously a lot of that was focused on his upbringing as well. We'll move on. So reasonably quickly here, because we'll get to Dermot Cleese and Fionn has to go. Sony Open field has Jordan Spieth, 6-1 favourite. Hideki Matsuyama, 7-1. Justin Thomas is victorious last week, 12-1. Paul Casey, 20-1. Thinking about that.
It's a good bet.
Jimmy Walker, 20-1. I'm thinking about that. He played well last week. Yeah. Jimmy Walker, 20s. Justin Rose is 30. Brant Snedeker, 25-1. And on they go. It's obviously always windy there. Jason Day says he's refusing this year to play quickly because last year he felt a little bit rushed, and so he's going back to what he liked doing, which is closing his eyes and puffing out his cheeks. He said, I've got to get back to what makes me good. If that means I have to back off the ball 5 times, then I'm going to back off the ball 5 times before I have to actually hit the shot. I think it was just one of the things that it wasn't as deliberate as I should have been last year, and I'm going to try and do that more. And so initially everybody criticised him and says, what the hell? I saw Ewan Murray wrote a piece and was defending Jason Day and, you know, said there's tons of players who were just as slow as him. Stenson, Garcia jumped to mind, he says. And Ewan Murray says, the notion that Day must be wildly castigated for his sentiment is unfair on quite a number of levels. Day, like McIlroy, will advance the sport by winning marquee tournaments. Maybe. I think he could still speed up, to be honest.
I think he's perfectly fine the way he is. Yeah.
His biggest mistake was his honesty.
I was going to say
that. Because he's going to be watched.
But he's already being, like, they're lambasting him on the American golf sites. Mm. Here, like, just to summarise.
Yeah.
Jason Day is drawing a huge distinction between the professional golfer and all that's required to achieve anything in professional golf, and the club golfer or the amateur golfer.
Well, wait until you hear Galise on the club golfer. Selfish is the word. Selfish.
My point is that, like I play 5-a-side, okay? We all play 5-a-side. Like, do you go training 3 times a week?
Yeah.
To play? No, you don't. So, do you know, my
have
point
you,
is...
Have you seen me with my top off?
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Sure.
He's going, yeah, for... And to quote... Because for recreational golf, this is the idea of speeding up. I understand, but for golfers that are trying to win and that one shot that could take you out of a playoff, that's important. Yeah. And you need to make sure that you get everything correct because we're driven by results. We want to be the best and we want to do everything, but the average Joe just doesn't get it. Now, Nathan, you said, it's brutally honest.
Yeah, like I agree with a lot of his point. I don't have an issue with golfers taking a long time in the back nine of the Masters.
Yeah.
There's so much at stake.
Yeah.
And it adds to the tension almost of what's about to happen. Yeah. But for your average golf fan or average sports fan who's tuning in and is watching a 5.25-hour round, they just won't stick with it.
Mm.
They don't want to wait 10 minutes between each
shot. No, sure. Look, there are times where you're watching golf and there may not be television coverage of many golfers on a certain night. You know, it's an average tournament. They haven't sent out all the cameras and all the inserts, and so there are nights where they might just be following 2 or 3 groups effectively and you are stuck watching the slowest golf.
But
and
that it doesn't happen that often.
I feel it happens enough for me to notice it and be kind of, oh no.
So I don't mind it in the biggest tournaments.
Well, the biggest tournaments is fine because actually the tension fills the gaps.
Yeah.
Like the, you know, Jordan Spieth as he's dropped on the 12th and is taking an age over what is then his third shot in the Masters. He can take 10 minutes because it's unbelievably exciting and the tension is fantastic. The first round of the Winnebago Masters, when Jason Day has taken 5 minutes on the second. Look, I think it's a weakness in the game. I understand his perspective, but just as a consumer of it, I find it a bit slow.
I would make the following argument. It's up to the TV coverage. It's up to the stations covering it. One of the big criticisms of more recent in the last 10 years, say, of TV, is that they focus on too few golfers.
No, fair enough, yeah.
So here's the thing. Here's an option. The guys are taking whatever. Broaden it out. Mm-hmm. Focus on 25 golfers, not the top 10 guys, and then have a far more democratic view. So you don't have to watch Jason Day back off a shot 5 times. You can move back and forth. I think it's up to the
surely
TV.
Surely there's a reason, Fionn, that they do that. Surely they have looked into people's viewing patterns and realise when Jason Day is on camera,
yeah,
people are willing to hang around, whereas if you decide to go to Johnson Wagner, they go, who's this guy? I'm switching off.
Okay, well then...
Maybe that defeats my point that they will hang around.
I was just going to say,
that this doesn't make any sense coming out with this, because we saw what happened with Keegan Bradley a couple of years ago. Once it was really focused on about his slow play, every single comment was,
Day shouldn't have said this. Because this is now, he is now, you know,
he's made a rod for his own back.
And
there's no doubt.
Because he says he felt rushed in 2016, as if he's not going to be increasingly conscious of it now when he realizes everybody is focused.
I think
on
that's
it.
Absolutely true. Yeah. He's definitely made a rod for his own back, and he's drawn undue attention to himself when he is. It's so counterintuitive because he's trying to take the attention. I mean,
I would wonder when he closes his eyes now and puffs out his cheeks, is he thinking, everybody knows I'm taking for ages. It's just like you practice meditation. There are thoughts.
They come.
You know, you fight the thoughts, but they're there because even just the fact that you're fighting them means they're there. So at some point, he's going to be closing his eyes going, everybody's really noticing.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It's whether as to the wisdom of making the statement in the first place. I agree with you.
Yeah.
He'd probably been wise not to say anything.
But you think he can take as damn long as he pleases?
Yeah, I do. Okay. And I think
there is... beautiful new Nike gear.
Yeah, yeah.
He looks well in that Nike gear.
I just think that there is a difference. And I think that this idea...
If you ignore that.
I am. I'm sorry. I'm just going to...
Who doesn't?
Yeah, only...
I find the Nike gear garish most of the time. I don't like it.
Do you think Day Glow, the colours are a bit kind of poppy?
Yeah, I feel like it's too... There's too much going on with too much of the Nike gear for me. I like some of it.
Mm, but the black. I like the matte black with the little shiny Nike swoosh.
Nice.
Red.
Some of it's good.
Sunday red. Like, that's an interesting colour.
I don't know why. It just came into my head.
I saw Day wearing red trousers and a black t-shirt with white sleeves and white shoes. And I thought, you know, it was okay.
Maybe at some other point we might take a look at...
our favourite golf gear.
Wearing white trousers.
Well, if suppliers could send us samples, then we'd obviously... Wow, I mean, you need to know how it feels in your hands.
White trousers?
I mean, the club golfer...
I mean, if they were sent in and they were of my size, then I could make a decision.
What is your size?
Getting reduced by the week, so get them in quick because I'll need
Club golfers wearing, you know, colourful trousers is just a big no-no for me. Not least because, like, they get dirty.
Now, it's also as well, is this, again, it's a bit like the 16-year-old kid playing football on the local green showing up, like, not just with the jersey, but the shorts and the socks.
Full kit.
Like, if you're not the best footballer in the entire county, get that kid off you right now.
The world rankings, by the way, as we head into 2017, are Jason Day 1, McIlroy 2, Johnson is 3, Dustin. Henrik Stenson is 4, Spieth is 5, Matsuyama 6, who we mentioned, Scott 7, Patrick Reed 8. As we head on for Royal Birkdale is where the Open will be, Erin Hills for the US Open, and Quail Hollow. Mm. I mean, can you bet on Rory today? For Quail Hollow will be the PGA. So I'm giving McIlroy 2 to 3 majors this year.
Wow.
What? Really?
Well, I think he just will win a Quail Hollow if he's in good form.
Yeah.
And I fancy him for the Masters this year.
Do you?
Yeah, I think he's become accustomed to the hype and the pressure. I just feel like you look at that piece with Kimmich, I think he's in a good place. And I think he's swinging the club well. So I think this actually will be the Masters year. And then he's been on the poxy side of the draw in the British Open since he won at Liverpool. He literally has been screwed by the draw. So three majors. And probably win Erin Hills.
You're going to play Dermot Galise. I caught the end of it when you were talking about 2017. Yeah. I think he was making a good point. There's, you look at that top 10, there's a lot of incredibly talented golfers.
Yeah.
But the thing to look out for in 2017 is McIlroy and Spieth. Because yeah. of all of them, they're the two that can achieve all-time greatness.
All-time,
that this may sum up as to whether McIlroy, this year may sum up whether McIlroy can get to double figures, whether Spieth can get to 7-8 majors.
Can what I get to Day on for the Masters?
No one's feeling so good about Day. I don't know why.
Is it because he's the back, the injury problems? It's, he's a bit fragile.
Yeah, I think it's part of it. He's not as outrageously talented as the other two. Oh, he's, I mean, well, he's obviously a supreme ball striker.
He hits the ball as far as
I don't know. I've yet to meet anyone who has a really good feeling about Day. I don't know why. There's no obvious reason.
No, I agree. I agree. There's this weird. He's number one in the world. Yeah. He's, and yet the people talk about Jordan Spieth, including us, with far more certainty than we do about Jason Day.
It feels as though Day is a 3-4 year player who'll win a couple of majors within that,
and then go back into comfortable top 15.
Yeah, top 10. Whereas McIlroy and Spieth are here for the next 10-15 years.
I'd agree with that.
We'll give you our final thoughts in a moment. Here's Dermot Galise, though. Firstly, we'll get to him next. So Dermot Galise popped into studio on Sunday. He's writing with the Sunday Independent. He's been covering golf for a long time now. I think he's done his 100th major in the year just gone.
That's extraordinary.
Which is impressive. So we just had lots of time on a Sunday, so it's always good to get Dermot Gleeson to talk about golf. We talk about 2017. We talk about Tiger's breakthrough at Augusta 20 years ago this year. So here he is.
Happy New Year, Joe.
You did a very interesting thing in the newspaper today. The traditionalists.
That makes a change.
The traditionalists will have been interested. Neil Manship out at Carton House, who was a fine player and ball striker in his day.
It wasn't Neil. It was Noel Fox.
Oh, Noel Fox, sorry.
Yeah,
of course,
Neil,
Noel Fox.
I met Neil, but Neil's a fine guy, but he just happened to be there.
Okay. And Neil is Shane Larry's
coach.
He had no wish
to hit those clubs, I can tell you that.
Okay.
But, Noel Fox is a terrific guy. Mm. I mean, dare I say, he's probably the most knowledgeable man on golf that I know. And I mean that, Noel. He's
really?
An amazing guy.
Noel's in his 40s.
Yeah, be early, very early.
Very 40s. Early 40s,
very
yeah.
early 40s.
Late 30s.
Yeah. Late 30s. Late 40-ish, yeah.
Yeah.
But he's an amazing guy. He's extraordinarily knowledgeable on golf.
Okay. And a fine player. Record of 60 at Mullingar?
That's right, yeah. And he could have, he drove a couple of the par fours, obviously.
Yeah.
Very, very long. And that's why I thought he'd be particularly interesting to do this. Apart from the fact that he's such an enthusiast, you know, he couldn't resist it. You know, he couldn't resist the challenge of doing it. You know, so I think I picked my man well. But he was great.
You dreamt the challenge up, which was,
and there wasn't a challenge as such. It was just the O'Connor family, Christie's family, God rest them. They gave him a gift at Christmas. My wife and I dropped down to see Mary and we met a few of the offspring at Christmas, you know, more or less a seasonal call, as it were. And Christopher, who would be one of Christie's twin sons, told me that he had promised me clubs, and he produced these two clubs anyway. And he said, look, that's a gift.
Wow.
So that you can remember my dad, you know. And I thought it was lovely, particularly nice since Christy had actually hit these clubs himself,
wow.
you know.
Yeah. It's a little slice of history there.
Yeah, so then I had the idea that I wonder what they're like for a modern player, you know, to hit these.
Yeah.
And as the game was played, and Noel did it. He was happy to do it, and it was very interesting. I mean, his best hit with it was an old Fred Smith RC10. It was called an RC10 to commemorate Christie's 10 successive Ryder Cups, and it was a 3-iron.
So what kind of decade would Christie have been hitting this club in?
In the 70s.
Right.
And anyway, Noel hit it, he had 3 goals at it, 3 or 4 I think, and he hit it 218 yards, which is a hell of a good dig with a 3-iron of any description, you know, but particularly one that age. No peripheral weighting, I mean, you know, no balance that we would be aware of nowadays. And then he hit a normal, a modern Titleist, and he hit a 2-2-1, you know. So there was virtually no difference between the two of them, which I thought was very interesting.
That is interesting, which suggests that the ball was the all-important
tool. The ball is the key. I mean, everybody is talking about, they're window dressing about clubs and stuff like that. But there's no question the golf ball has made all the difference.
So Noel Fox hitting his normal Titleist club now, as opposed to Christy O'Connor's 3-wood from the 70s.
Three iron, excuse me.
10, 15 yards difference, 20
yards?
No,
3 yards.
3 yards?
Oh, sorry. 218 to 221.
218 to 221.
Yeah, I mean, and that was just by chance. I mean, I'm assuming that if Noel had got used to the to Christie's club, he probably would have hit it out there about the same as the modern club. So the point, it didn't really prove anything. What it did prove was that the sweet spot on the margin of error on the old club was virtually nil. You know, if you didn't catch it sweet, you were going to hit a bad shot.
Okay.
Nowadays, you don't catch it flush and you're going to get away with it. You're going to hit a moderate shot, you know. And that's really what I was trying to establish, which Noel thankfully did, you know.
Yes.
But, it was a bit of fun. Don't take it too seriously,
I'm not saying it was a scientific process, but it's interesting. I would have thought there'd be more of a difference.
Yeah, well, the thing like that Sandy Lyle used to always talk about the shaft being the key of any golf club. And, you know, somebody would say, do you like the look of that iron? And he'd say, like, I mean, it's the shaft I'm interested in. What sort of a shaft is in it?
Right.
And so we have a 40-year-old shaft, which effectively performed every bit as well as a brand new modern shaft. And that's what I found interesting.
Because, you know, Paul McGinley and others would say, and they would, I mean, they would always say it's gone too far now and it's gone too late and there's sponsors and there's money involved. But really, the ball should have been nipped in the bud.
Oh, yeah.
Some years ago. It's the ball which has allowed the players to hit the huge distances and make such brilliant golf courses, older golf courses, a bit redundant.
Well, it's very sad. I mean, Nicklaus was the first to really make an issue of it, you know, because as a golf course designer himself, I mean, he saw his own work becoming redundant virtually before it was finished, you know. I mean, he'd designing a golf course over a period of, say, 3-4 years, working on it. And during that time, I mean, the changes that were taking place. But the most significant one, I think, occurred around 2000, when the Pro V Titleist brought in the Pro V1. Now, the Pro V1 was essentially a pinnacle with a soft cover. But whatever technology they were able to put into it, I mean, it made a huge difference. And the irony of it is, like, I remember growing up that it used to be a delight to get an old golf ball, you know, and you start picking it apart and all the bits of rubber string that it was wound with, you know.
Yeah.
There isn't one atom of rubber in a modern golf ball, you know. It's all synthetic material, which must tell us something, you know, about the changes that have taken place.
I hadn't actually planned to talk to you about any of this, but it's very interesting. Just another question or two. Do we anticipate that the ball will keep improving and improving and players will keep hitting it further and further, or will there just have to be some rule where it's brought in and the lawmakers say, look, no more. We want to have US Opens at Merion and have some measure of comparison between Ben Hogan and Justin Rose?
I think the legislators have thrown up their hands. They've given up the fight, you know. Not that the fight was ever there. I mean, they just sat back and watched this happen.
Right.
And obviously were aware of it, but commercial interests dominated the whole thinking, and which is very sad, but it's too late now. I don't know. I mean, how can I predict the changes in technology? But the general consensus is that the golf club itself is gone about as far as it can go in terms of peripheral weighting and all that sort of stuff. Now, whether you're going to get revolutionary new materials which are going to be able to create a new golf ball, I don't know. But I mean, I think I said this before when I was on with you. I mean, back in 1990, I was in San Diego, and I saw, you know, Boffins sitting behind television screens, and that's what they were working on. You know, they were working on what we're using nowadays. Which brought about a profound change. But I mean, it's interesting you should talk about length. I mean, I was reading some details about Erin Hills, where the US Open is going this year in June. And apparently it can be stretched to 8,100 yards.
I know. Game's gone.
Where are we going?
Tiger Woods made his much-awaited return in the Bahamas before Christmas. Rory McIlroy today in his piece with Paul Kimmich said he was very impressed. The swing looked rhythmic. Mm. Were you impressed with Tiger's return?
Well, I mean, if Rory says he's impressed, that's good enough for me.
Galise disagrees with McIlroy.
No, I mean, I've always maintained that the key to any future Tiger Woods may have in the game lies between his two ears. Nobody would ever question his talent to hit a golf ball.
Yeah.
Now, Rory is obviously infinitesimally more qualified to judge that end of things than I am. But I think what has happened, the injuries he's had over the years were almost predictable from the time I saw him win the Masters in 1997. Mm. Like, I've never seen anybody impart such obvious physical force at a golf ball. I mean, I would describe it as physical violence. And orthopedic surgeons at the time who observed Woods were of the view that something serious was going to happen to him physically, unless he had an extraordinary physique compared to the average human, which clearly he hasn't. That has since been established. But I remember Nick Faldo played with him in practice prior to the 96 Masters. And I remember Faldo coming into the media centre and just, he uttered three words, you know, with a sort of a gasp. And he said, serious shoulder speed.
Right.
He had never, ever seen anything quite like it. And you've got to remember, Joe, at that time, we're talking about 97, which is 20 years ago. At that time, only two pros in the world of golf were hitting the ball over 300 yards. And that was Woods and John Daly. Nobody else was. Now, I mean, I wouldn't want to do a count on that nowadays. Yeah. But you're talking hundreds.
Yeah.
Nowadays.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the exception is if we talk about players, like for instance, if you were analysing Graham McDowell, you'd be trying to find a way of explaining how he could master a course given his limited length, you know, of 285 or whatever he hits the ball.
He's practically embarrassed at 280.
Yeah. You'd be making an argument like to compensate for what he lacks compared to the average hitter. You know, the average hitter nowadays is hitting it, as I say, 310. Maybe, you know, you look at Rory, I mean, what, 340?
You can carry it that far sometimes. Yeah. So Woods is going to play four events in 5 weeks, actually, in the new year. He'll be back at Torrey Pines, where he likes.
That's interesting that he should have chosen Torrey Pines, which again brings me back to the mental aspect of things. He wants to go to a golf course. He's won there seven times, and that's where he won his last major, obviously, in June 08.
Yeah.
And he wants to go back to a place where he's going to feel comfortable.
Mm. He's also...
I think that's very significant.
Right. Well, he's going to do that on the 26th. Before that, we'll see him at the Honda Classic in Florida, just to let people know. He's going to play Riviera, which will be interesting, his tournament now.
Yeah.
And he'll do Dubai as well for the European Tour. So he's going to play all these events. Nota Begay says he will win in 2017.
Yeah, I think he would. I think he could. I mean, I don't see any reason why he couldn't. I mean, as I keep saying, Joe, I mean, technically, I mean, what we saw in the Hero Challenge before Christmas, there was certainly enough evidence there to suggest that much of the old skills remain. And I mean, he only needs about 50% of the game he once had, really, you know, to not to dominate, but to win. And, you know, mentally is what we're looking at, really.
Yeah. You were at Augusta in 97.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting story to tell about Faldo the year previous playing with the amateur Woods. I was just reading last night. So, like, Woods turned professional in late summer 96.
August 96 in Milwaukee.
Yeah. And, you know, so he'd had the stellar amateur career. But, you know, it was very striking that he arrived into Augusta in 1997 as a 21-year-old as the favourite.
Yeah.
The pre-tournament favourite to win.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was this just based on, like, had people seen him? Had golfers at large, had golf fans at large seen much of Woods? He hadn't won any professional event. His amateur career was stellar, but, like, did you expect him to win? Can you remember the pre-tournament feel about Woods?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, people talked about nobody else. I mean, I saw him for the first time in Porthcawl in 1995 in the Walker Cup, where I remember his main concern at that occasion was getting to local McDonald's for a Big Mac. And there was a big talk about that, you know, that Tiger had to... he was almost addicted to the bloody things. You know, he used to have to seek out the local McDonald's anywhere. Incidentally, right. You should charge them for that. But anyway.
It's two mentions. Three strikes and you're out.
But
I never knew that, actually.
That was 95. Now, at that time, Joe, I mean, everybody in golf was talking about Woods.
Okay.
He was phenomenal. I mean, he had won 6 US titles, remember, 3 junior in a row and then 3 seniors in a row. So he had played in quite a few professional tournaments and distinguished himself fairly competently.
Right, okay.
In those events. When he came to Augusta, the most surprising thing was actually a terrific story, really. On the first day, he shot 40 for the opening 9 holes, yeah. You know, and then it all started on the 10th then, you know, and it went on from there. But
shot a 30 on the back 9.
30 on the back 9, yeah, for an opening 70.
Yeah.
But I think the story I love most, I mean, well, the thing really started to take off on the Friday. So he was an interesting enough story on the Thursday, yeah. Like, I mean, in that he was, what, 3 strokes off the lead.
Yeah, John Huston.
Houston. Was leading. And then the second day he shoots a 66.
Right.
And he's now leading by 3, I think it was, from Monty, Colin Montgomery.
Yeah.
So that was a big, it was becoming a big story on the Friday because you had his back 9 of 30 on Thursday, then added to 66 on Friday.
I added 65
on Saturday.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah, maybe I got a wrong way around.
Okay, but either way, he went 66, which meant he was 9 shots
he
clear.
He was 9 shots clear. Actually, there's a lovely story about the Sunday. On the Sunday evening in Augusta, I mean, it was enormous buzz about the place after he'd won, obviously. Yeah. But I remember Paul Kimmage and myself were in a place called the Olive Garden, which is sort of a...
Suitably expensive. The good old days. This was on expenses, was it? 5 courses.
Expenses, the Olive Garden, yeah. It had Italian cuisine, and plenty of wine.
Good
which,
wine.
Which suited Paul. But anyway, we happened to meet Lee Elder there.
Oh, wow.
And I made a point I shouldn't have.
For non-golf fans, Elder, the first black player at Augusta.
This was it. You see, he was the first black player to play the Masters in 75. And I just couldn't resist going over to his table. I hate doing that, you know, because I can imagine how celebrities feel when idiots like me would come along.
Did you know him?
No, I didn't. Right, no, I knew of him, obviously.
But he didn't know you.
Funnily enough, I used Christy O'Connor as an entree because I knew that he had played Ryder Cup against Christy. No, he hadn't. Maybe. Well, he would have seen Christy. He knew of Christy.
Sure.
He may have played seniors with him. I can't remember. But anyway, he knew Christy.
Yeah.
So I used Christy as an excuse, as an idiot Irishman, you know, going over to upset him. But he was still sort of seriously wound up about Woods. But the great story was he was there. Elder was there.
Wound up as in excited?
Excited.
Oh,
wonderfully
yeah, okay.
Excited. Yeah. But he was there as a guest of Jackson Stevens, the chairman of Augusta National, who obviously felt that in the circumstances of what Woods was doing, the invitation went out that weekend, that of what Woods was doing, that to have the first black man there, it was a really nice gesture. To have him there would have been special. And as it happened, I mean, Elder was staying in Columbia, South Carolina, and apparently he had a problem on the Sunday morning. He was late getting up or whatever, and the upshot of it was, anyway, he put the foot down, heading for Augusta. And naturally enough, a state trooper was waiting for him and pulled him in and wanted to know what he was doing 85 miles an hour for, which is what he was doing apparently. And he said, he apologised and said he was going to Augusta National to see Tiger Woods win the Masters. And the state trooper turned to him and he said, "Who's Tiger Woods?" Wow. Which probably told you more about the thinking at that time. Wow. And the environment in which Woods was performing. Because it reminded me of a judge, like during the 1960s, some guy went before him and the Beatles came up as something in the conversation, and the judge, like thinking he was being smart,
yeah,
and would be remembered for it and get his name in the paper, said, "Who are the Beatles?"
Wow.
You know.
Yeah.
And I suspected that this was a state trooper who was just being ornery, as they say in the States.
It's inconceivable that weekend in the area he wouldn't have known Tiger Woods.
No.
And he probably didn't know he was speaking to who he was speaking to either.
No, he probably didn't, because Lee would have introduced himself, would have given his name as Lee Elder, which wouldn't have meant very much, you know.
Wow, that's amazing.
But I thought it was a lovely story from Elder, but there was no rancor there, really, you know. I mean, he was cited, actually, he got a fine.
He got
a ticket, but
because I mean, it was
but he was a beautiful, lovely man. That's what I remember Elder. Most. Yeah, I remember most about him. But then the buzz. The other thing I remember in the wake of that was Nicklaus, and I remember Nicklaus. He was brought in for or maybe some. We caught him actually around the 18th. In the moment of victory. And it was typical of Jack, you know, ever the pragmatist.
Yes.
He said, they'll have to make adjustments. Mm. You see, and we looked at him sort of, and he said, this place is supposed to be tough. And of course, Woods had just beaten his long-standing
record,
which he had shared with Raymond Floyd of 271. Woods had shot 18 under 270. But Nicklaus was quite prescient, really, you know, in that it was only a matter of a few years when the first thing that happened was that they put in rough in Augusta. Well, and then, of course,
you can't call it rough.
All right,
Dermot, primary. I want you to get back there. First cut. Jesper Parnevik, don't you dare, and don't refer to
Jesper Parnevik, who incidentally used to be using 9 wood. At that
Did
point,
he?
Yeah.
Well, he said at the time,
High flight into par three, sorry.
Right. He was saying, unless they build Tiger tees 50 yards back from the rest of us, he'll win the next 20 of these, was his quote in the day. And I saw Montgomery being interviewed. So he's 9 shots back on the Saturday. I just watched a clip during the week. He came into the press conference, I'm sure you remember, and he said, "We're all human. There is no way Tiger Woods will lose this tournament." And of course, he shot a 69, won by 12 shots in the end.
Won by 12 from Tom Kite. Yeah, I mean, it reminded, there were two things that stand apart in my golf writing career.
Right.
And they both involve Woods. As in, sort of, this is just staggering. One was that occasion, and the other was 2000 when he won the US Open by 15 strokes.
Yeah.
Like, what staggered me in 2000 was the absolute, the unbelievable quality of what he played around Pebble Beach. But the other was a 21-year-old having the effrontery to come to Augusta National and do what he did to the golf course. He was in 3 bunkers over the 72 holes, which means like that he wasn't as wayward as a lot of people were suggesting. They were suggesting that just because there was no rough there, he was able to hit it sideways and get away with it. He was certainly spraying it a bit, but he wasn't seriously wayward. Let's put it that way.
Right.
But by God, he was giving us some stick. He was sending it out there. I mean, you were looking at just something totally different than anything we'd ever seen before.
That's what I can't fully appreciate, probably, the difference. 44 million, which is still a record in America, 44 million Americans tuned in to watch Sunday, which was effectively a procession.
Yeah.
But, like, it was electrifying, the whole
sport. Yeah, I suppose the only thing comparable to it, and fully enough from another black man, was Muhammad Ali, you know, who would have generated that level of excitement.
Yeah.
And dare I say it, there would have been, I mean, colour didn't come into it, I'd say, for the average golf fan. I was just staggered at what they were witnessing. But colour was definitely a huge factor when we sat down to reflect on what had happened.
Yes.
I mean, here was a black man changing the rules, as it were, you know.
Well, you mentioned Lee Elder there.
Yeah.
So he played in 75, you know.
Played in six Masters, yeah.
In 77, you still have Clifford Roberts, who, you know, 77 Clifford Roberts dies, who the New York Times attributed that comment to him: as long as I'm alive, all the golfers will be white, all the caddies will be black.
Yeah.
This wasn't any old golf course that the 21-year-old Woods had just torn apart. And the mad thing is, so he, like, within by that summer, he's world number one. It's just a fait accompli.
But that's why I thought it was, it could have been considered political, but what Jackson Stevens did in inviting Elder, because Elder had no right to be at the Masters. He was only an ordinary Joe, as it were. I mean, the fact that he was black was
incidental.
Yeah. But he had no right to be there. But it was to mark what, obviously, what Stevens anticipated was going to be a monumental happening in golf.
Can I ask you, and I don't know if they've spoken about it, I don't know the answer to this, just the year previously, and it's a Masters etched in everyone's consciousness, you have Faldo and the Norman collapse.
Yeah.
Did Woods arriving and bombing the ball 300 yards, did that just mentally finish those two? Like, did Faldo kind of disappear?
Faldo, what do you mean? Did this disappear from one's consciousness?
No, did they disappear in the sense they realised, oh my God, you can literally pinpoint where our era ended?
Oh, there's no question that it was the changing of the baton. There's no doubt about that. Faldo tried to make sense of it, and one of the more interesting comments he made, and Faldo's a very fair-minded guy, you know. I mean, he's sometimes he gets a pretty bad press about things, but I found him to be largely fair-minded. But he said, somebody was saying, he was asked the obvious question, like, I mean, is this fellow just going to beat everything before him, you know?
Yeah.
Can he be stopped? Is there any way of competing against him? And Faldo, I'll never forget it, he said, let's see what happens when he starts missing a few putts.
Hmm.
In other words, that ultimately, it's still going to depend on getting the ball in the hole. But then, of course, what happened then was that Woods became the best putter, arguably, we've ever seen. You know, I mean, better even than Nicklaus.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to look at that. I find that the Woods development, interesting in the context, for instance, of Jordan Spieth, who was a similar age when he broke through. And we had Spieth threatening to totally dominate 2 years ago, what, in 2015. Mm. And then very quiet year last year. And it struck me that if you look at Woods, I mean, Woods wins the Masters by a street, and you're wondering, like, I mean, how many is he going to pile up in the next year? He didn't win another for 10 majors.
Mm.
Didn't win another until the end of 1999.
Went to work in his swing.
He went, well, I think that, that would be part of it, obviously. But I think the bigger part of it, Joe, would have been that he had to adjust to huge commercial demands, which were made on him.
Right.
As world number one, as the hottest property in golf. The same thing would have happened to Spieth. I mean, you can imagine the dragging out that Spieth would have, the pressure that Spieth would have had to contend with commercially. And the difficulty a player faces, you can say, like, I mean, that if he's true to his code, as it were, I mean, he should pick and choose and stand back and only be selective.
It's hard, though.
I mean, you can't. You've got your future to take care of. You don't know if the game is going to leave you.
Funny, Harrington did a few spots of commentary with Sky last year, and he was asked about Spieth when we were watching Spieth, and, you know, quiet year by comparison with 15, and Harrington said, he's too nice at the moment off the course, too nice to everyone, he's saying yes to too many things, he'll learn. So exactly what you're saying. Somebody points out Faldo was struggling anyway in 97, he needed a pick from Seve to play at Valderrama. Sure, but I'm almost throwing Norman into that. I'm almost wondering, like, it's rare in sport where you can almost pinpoint the day that there was a baton change in a sport like golf, and
quite
incredible.
Oh yeah, because if you look at what happened in the aftermath, I remember the excitement, for instance, at Medina in 1999 at the PGA Championship there, when when Garcia emerged as a possible rival for Woods, and everybody, and on this little skip and jump he made on the 16th after hitting the ball from the base of a tree. And there was huge excitement about that, and Ben Crenshaw made some charming comment about it. And it was all to do with where's the next challenge going to come from?
Yeah.
You know, who's going to be the next? The same thing is in, I remember in the late 70s, everybody was talking about what became known as the Bear Apparent, you know, the next Jack Nicklaus. And, you know, it was Ben Crenshaw and then it was Al Sutton.
Mm.
And it was all these names. Everybody's looking for a new hero, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, the king is dead, long live the king type of stuff.
In truth, it won't happen for a while.
Yeah.
Christy O'Connor is an entree. What did Dermot Cleese have as the main course, wonders Sticky and Drimna? This was your Lee Elder story where you used use Christy as an entree.
Well, given that it was the Olive Garden, it was probably chicken.
Can you stick around for 10 more minutes?
Sure.
Okay,
sure.
We'll take a short break. Dermot Cleese staying with us. Dermot Cleese of the Sunday Independent is still with us. So I'll get on to slow play in just a moment, but I wanted to just get your broad sense of what you're looking out for in the year ahead. Tiger coming back, we've discussed.
Yeah.
And that will be thrown in on top of world number one, Jason Day, world number two, Rory McIlroy. Dustin Johnson is three with his major in his pocket. Henrik Stenson with his major in his pocket is four. Yeah. Jordan Spieth is five. Matsuyama is playing bloody good. And he's six. Adam Scott, seven. Patrick Reed, post his Ryder Cup heroics, is eight.
Yeah.
There's a lot of talent there.
There's huge talent there, yeah.
This is one of those years where things are in flux. We might get more of a natural order in 12 months' time.
We might. The two players that I would be most interested in this year would be Rory and Jordan Spieth. I think, will be in and out a bit, as will, Dustin Johnson. I don't see consistency in Dustin Johnson. I don't see him dominating the game like, for instance, Tiger did. Mm. But there's huge talent in Spieth. I think we have to accept that. I mean, not only is he a great putter, but I mean, he has a good game, tee to green, and he's clearly a very good competitor.
Mm.
And I would like to see what happens to him this year. I'm anxious to see it because that will set a marker for what we're likely to expect from him for the next 10 years, I think.
Mm.
Rory's Rory. I mean, we want him. I definitely want him to win the Masters so that he'll have the career slam.
Yeah.
I think Rory will continue to win majors on a regular basis. Now, Birkdale is interesting, particularly interesting this year, in that we have Patrick Harrington going back to the place he won, not his first, curiously, but his second.
Oh,
in other words, he's going back to
defend Birkdale.
Going back to Birkdale before he goes back to Carnoustie.
Yeah.
But that will be particularly interesting. And then you have two new venues. I mean, you have Erin Hills in Wisconsin, which has never staged the US Open before, and then you have Quail Hollow, which is...
Well, that's Rory's back garden, isn't
it? Yeah, which will be staging a major for the first time at the PGA Championship. So that should be particularly interesting. I think it's a fascinating year.
Mm.
The Open is something like that. We know what the Open's going to be like. It's just a change of venue, but we know the venue, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So there's nothing very particularly fresh other than the challenges, obviously. But I would be very interested in Erin Hills because of the nature of the golf course. It's a sprawling, obviously an inland course, hilly, I'm told, with no trees.
Right.
So it's going to be windswept. And we can assume that the USGA are not going to make the same mess of it that they did of Chambers Bay 2 years ago.
Assume nothing.
Anyway.
Does Birkdale suit Rory in particular, or is it just more of the same? It depends on conditions.
Any golf course suits Rory. To be on his game, any golf course. I mean, if you look at how Harrington finished in 08 at Birkdale, I mean, they were the sort of shots that Rory would absolutely relish, like 5-wood off the tee in the long 17th, which of course is running fast and hard now, we've got to remember.
Yeah.
And then another 5-wood of 273 yards, which is astonishing if you think about it, just in terms of the club, to set up an eagle on the 17th. They're the sort of shots you could picture Rory hitting. Birkdale is a very good test, obviously. They're all good tests. Yeah. But given what Rory did at Royal Liverpool, I mean, you know, I don't think he needs a particular type of course to show us his best.
If anything, I mean, he's been a bit unlucky with the draw in most recent Opens. He's really been on the wrong side of the draw.
That's true.
That's
true.
And Quail Hollow, he's run routinely in 2010. He was first win on PGA Tour. He loves Quail Hollow. So we're giving him three majors plus a shot at Erin Hills. Is that what we're saying?
Well, I hope so.
And Spieth, we'll see. One of the differences from afar, everything we're saying here, I guess, is from afar, but between maybe Spieth and Johnson, and I agree with your point, for all the talent Johnson has, is I feel like Jordan Spieth has bristled for about 3 months now and is very angry and has worked very hard. Whereas I just feel Dustin Johnson's not inundated with too many thoughts.
I think that's a reasonable comment.
Right, okay. Without being too harsh on him.
But I think, the point about Spieth is that I think that we're looking at a player who could be a serious competitor long term.
Right.
But I think we're probably going to have a better idea of that after this year.
Last point then. Jason Day was speaking. He's playing in Hawaii at the moment.
Yeah.
And he was saying, you know, so Jason Day would have a reputation as a slow player. He, you know, does that closing the eyes and visualization business and then shakes the clubs, waggles the club a lot. In my opinion, I don't care so much about speeding up my game this year. I've got to get back to what makes me good. If that means I have to back off five times, then I'm going to back off five times before I hit the shot. I think that was just one of the things that I wasn't as deliberate as I should have been last year. And so this year, I'm going to make sure I do everything correctly. Slow play is like one of the great, great scourges of the game at amateur and professional level.
Yeah, I think, certainly at amateur level, I have a very clear view on that. I mean, I think it's just pure selfishness. We live in a very selfish society. I mean, it's manifested in road rage and stuff like that. I mean, road rage was unheard of when I was growing up. I mean, honestly.
Was it?
Nobody, on my word of honour, Joe, never.
Were there as many cars?
There weren't as many cars. I accept that. I mean, there are a lot of factors that contribute
traffic
to
it.
Yeah, there are a lot of factors. No, the traffic nowadays is no worse than it was 20, 30 years ago because Dublin is bypassed. We seem to forget that. Mm. I mean, when I was in my, 20s, 30s, 40s, I was anywhere I wanted to go on the south side, I had to go through Dublin.
Okay.
And the place was chock-a-block. But honestly, I didn't encounter the level of road rage. Well, any road rage. Right. I mean, maybe it was there, but I just wasn't aware of it.
Right.
In golf, the attitude in golf seems to be like, screw you, I'm on the golf course, I've paid my sub. If it takes me 5 hours to go around here, so be it. I think at amateur level, at club level, it is absolutely selfishness. No other reason. I can think of no other reason. Because I can play golf at a level worse than most people I know, and I'm not slow. Mm. Fellas will tell you that.
Mm.
So people will say, like, the standard of play, if you're playing badly, it's going to take you longer. I don't believe that.
I presume it's the pre-shot routines which have changed.
It's the pre-shot routines. It's what they're seeing on television. Yeah. But behind it all, Joe, it is pure selfishness. Okay. Now, as far as the pros are concerned, I would put the problem partially down to there's no longer any fear of authority. There was a time when a PGA official or an RNA official, they went out in the golf course in their blazer and they put the fear of God up, any right. professional who was going to be slow. I just give you, for instance, give you an idea of changing times, and this hasn't changed. In 1964, the Martini tournament, a big ball tournament, as an experiment, was played at Wentworth.
The Martini tournament?
The Martini tournament.
Right, okay.
It was a big ball tournament. Normally, the big ball didn't come in permanently, I think, until 73 in tournaments on this side of the pond. But because of the Ryder Cup and stuff like that, and there was a general feeling that it required, the big ball was a way of testing the pure striking quality of a player. Anyway, they ran this big ball tournament, Martini sponsored, Wentworth, Old Course, or sorry, the Burma Road, West Course, 1964. Right. Christy O'Connor, that was a time, incidentally, when you played two rounds on a Saturday.
Right.
On the Saturday morning, Christy O'Connor went out at 7:30 for his third round in the morning.
Yeah.
Right? He had a break for lunch, which would have been a beer and a sandwich. And he walked off the 18th at 3:04 that afternoon as the winner by 6 shots from Peter Alice. Now, as the fella says, do the math.
Mm. Wow.
He played 36 holes of golf with a break in between from 7:30 until 3:04 in the afternoon.
Mm.
That tells me all I need to know.
Right.
Now, there is another point, and I won't go on, but there is another point which John Parmore, the chief referee of the European Tour, will tell you. And he believes that this is critical to the whole problem nowadays. At the time that Christie would have done that, greens were probably running at around 7-8 maybe maximum on the stimp meter.
Okay.
Which meant that your second putt at a par 4, if you were 2 putting for par, your second putt was more than likely just going to be a tap in from a foot.
Mm.
Nowadays, because of the speed of greens, which are running at 12, 13, sometimes we're at 14 at Oakmont last year, the ball is going to run on 3, 4, even 5 feet past, which is causing players to stop, eye up the putt, do their routine, go through the whole procedure. Mm. And when you factor that in to a field of 156 players,
yeah,
you've got major problems.
That's adding up, yeah. Right. Okay.
And that is one of the key factors. But Jason Day is absolutely right. I mean, there's nothing more frustrating than to be playing briskly and to find yourself standing waiting on those ahead of you. So the better, the more prudent, the more logical thing to do is to slow yourself down to their pace, you know, so that everybody's playing at an even pace. But it's still not right, Joe, you know.
Yeah.
But I think that the bottom line in the whole thing is that there is no longer any fear of authority.
Yeah.
In other words, there's a lot of beating of breasts and all sorts of stuff by the authorities saying, we must speed up play,
yeah,
we must do this, these fellas are going to be fined, we're going to impose 2-shot penalties.
Well, the last player I can remember
doesn't happen.
The last player I can remember getting the shot penalty is the 14-year-old at the Masters a couple of years ago.
The only person in the States who has ever imposed a penalty over there was the same John Parmore, who was a European Tour man, because he could impose the penalty and then flee the country.
Okay. Not so easy for the US guy. He has to see them next week.
Probably not.
Thanks so much for coming in. An hour has just zipped by. Dermot Leese of the Sunday Independent with us. Thank you very much. And that was Dermot Leese. So, we're up and running for 2017, everyone.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts?
My golf game's back.
Nothing. We should just leave that hanging
there. Yeah, sure it is.
Just saying.
Sure it is. Could the friends of the pod who played with Fionn tweet us in and let us know how he actually played, please?
Yep, no problem. How's your game, Joe?
Not here.
No, it's not. It's not as... Is it as 5-star as it was years ago?
It wouldn't be as sharp, but I played with Keith Andrews, actually. Not to drop a name.
But I have done.
Yeah. At Killeen. And I hadn't really... You know, I hadn't done much... I was 1 over after 6. So that was back in the... And then I kind of got a bit tired and a bit loose and it was Christmas. But I was like, right, okay, good, it's still here. There were still lots of drives and then greens and regulation and 2 putts. So that's back into the territory of flirting with 80 again. So yeah, no, I'm delighted.
This is an interesting new dynamic that I'm looking forward to seeing in 2017.
Oh yeah.
Because obviously Fionn had his dip.
Yeah.
And there was just the tone that he asked you about your game. He was
the competitive edge is back.
Well,
oh, good. So we can get out and have some battles that Mark Frost will write about one day. What was I going to say? I tell you what, dear, was interesting. Because we've got to go. This pod's the longest ever already. Robbie Cannon is Shane Larry's fitness coach, and I went out to see him. And so it turns out my flexibility, like everybody's flexibility, who is just a normal human being, is very, very bad.
Mm.
So 6, 7, 8, 9 weeks ago now, he gave me just various stretches, lower back, you know, twisting to the side, everything. And I actually do think I'm swinging nicer, easier. I feel like there's less kind of
moving
in my
parts.
Swing. No, not less kind of
yeah, yeah,
just
yeah.
more kind of back and through. And I might I might share some of the exercises with you guys. You can see, but
maybe do a Facebook Live video, Joe. We yeah, really enjoy
I was
that.
Talking to a yoga teacher.
Foam rolling.
Oh yeah,
all that kind of stuff. So a lot of foam rolling, which
foam
you've never
rolling,
done.
Not quite painful.
I mean, for the first 2 weeks, I mean agony because I'd never done it before. Agony.
Really?
Oh my god! I thought this can't be good, and now I've de-knotted.
Wow!
I've de-knotted all the kind of muscle tissue which had knotted up in my back and in my glutes and in my thighs.
So you're just put the foam bar or whatever
you
it
do
is,
your back
and just move your back up and down.
Not as vigorously as that. Very slow. You're kneeling it. I mean, you're replicating a deep tissue massage.
Wow!
And even I didn't realize my thighs were like horrifically tight, and they're still actually a bit sore in the foam roller. Oh. So there's that stuff. There's it's just 7 or 8 stretches for your back and your sides in particular. And your hips. And final point, he said, whatever decade of life you're in, so if you're in your 30s, it's 30%, 40s, 40%, 50s, 50%, and so on. That is the percentage of your workout which should be solely down to flexibility training.
Very, and it echoes, I was speaking to a yoga teacher who specializes or who has a specialty in helping golfers of all levels with flexibility.
Yeah.
And one of the things she was saying, she just gave me a little tip, and I wonder, have you ever come across this on any of your kind of search for the right golf swing? Is that yes, you need to be flexible and everything you just said, but that a good swing thought is that imagine you have a golf ball or a mandarin orange between your shoulder blades. And so yes, your posture is like you're sitting on the bar stool, but that like, too many golfers, their shoulders kind of roll forward.
Oh yeah, huge. Well, there's a stretch that Cannon gave me. It's the one thing that you have to do every day.
Okay.
And it's to I will show it to you in a minute here. And if you do it every day, and it's only 10 stretches, so it's like 1, 2. You do it 10 times, you will stand up, and your posture will have changed. And what you'll notice is, my God, my chest feels 6 foot wider than it was. We're all rolling our shoulders.
Yeah, we're all moving. And so that's what she was saying. You roll your shoulders forward, and then it creates all kinds of problems. But if you imagine that you have to keep this golf ball between your shoulder blades, it keeps your chest wide open.
Noel Fox says that, wide chest.
Yeah.
And you need a wide chest.
So you're keeping as wide as possible. And that way, like when you go back, it was quite literally eye-opening.
Yeah,
I was just like, wow, that's
incredible. If you're playing your golf, just think, God, my shoulders are rolled in here.
Yeah.
You gotta get that wide chest. Yeah. Anyway.
Nathan?
Says the two hackers.
Yeah, I'm hoping to play maybe in May.
We're thinking we'll do a Golf Weekly Day classic.
Yeah, definitely for 2017. At one of the major hosts, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, Turnberry.
Yeah. Okay. We'll be back next week. I presume you're around. Okay, good. Bye. All my exes wear Rolexes, but I reside right here.